And Jesse Alcoholic, I have an announcement. It's actually to vote on this meeting. There is Lee C. from Orchid brought to my attention that the Orchid speaker meeting is usually on the second Saturday of the month. But for December, it's being pushed to the third Saturday, which is our Saturday. So Billy suggested last month that we just push our date to the second Saturday on December in order to keep our meeting, and they can keep the third Saturday that just for that month. So I wanted to do a vote on that, get a group conscience instead of just making that call myself. So all in favor for keeping the meeting December and pushing it to the second Saturday.
You mean September?
December. So this is, we're voting about December.
Oh, all yeah, those yeah. months ahead?
2 months ahead, yeah.
September, October, November, December.
Right. Yeah, no, it's oh yeah. So but yeah, December is what we're voting on. Is that
seems like a good idea, I'll second that.
Okay. Any rejections to that? Alright, then we're rolling with it. Okay, so December, thanks for pointing out that it's way ahead for sure. But yeah.
Cool.
I'll definitely be announcing it.
Was that 2019?
Yes. Wow. All right. I hope this stays on the recording. Okay.
Is it being recorded?
Yeah, it's being recorded. Awesome. Okay, and then we also do birthdays here. We celebrate 365 continuous days of sobriety. Please stand if you've recently celebrated in this month a birthday, and tell us your name and number of years.
Hi.
Hey.
Hi. I'm Rain. I'm an alcoholic, and I'm celebrating
10
years.
Wow, right on.
10 years.
What was your name again?
Rain.
Rain.
Yes.
Awesome. Yeah, it's crazy. All right. Cool. All right. And now it gives me great pleasure, and I really am stoked to have you up here, man. Our speaker this evening is Matt D. from Orchid. Hey, brother.
Hey, everybody. My name is Matt. I'm an alcoholic. Very grateful to be alive and sober. Thanks for everyone showing, and thanks, Jesse, for asking me, man. So my sobriety date is December 1st, 2016, and so I'm coming up on 3 years, and I have a home group, and it appears to be the Sunday morning secret men's stag, but if you want to know where that's at, I can tell you that too. That seems to be the meeting where I'm kind of gravitating towards every week, religiously. So I want to start out, I'm not going to make this like a workshop, but I just like to use the book a lot because I've used this book like throughout my whole sobriety. I started coming to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1998, and my first sponsor was Victor T. Some of you guys know Victor. And he was telling me the same stuff that he says today, the same stuff that he shares in meetings. He was saying, I didn't hear any of it. None of it, man. And I just couldn't get sober, and I didn't know why. So this time when I came in, I was beat up enough. Welcome to the new guys, by the way. I hope you, I hope sincerely that you hear something that helps you possibly start this path that I'm on. This is incredible where I've gone from, and I hope that you get the gravitude, the magnitude of what's happened in my life. So I'm going to start out with something that I just thought of it. Whatever I was going to talk about, I was like, what am I going to talk about? Well, God, all right, I'm sure that you're going to guide me in this. He's been guiding me for almost 3 years now, so... First, I'm going to start with a story. It says, it's on page 26. It says, a certain American businessman had great ability, good sense, and high character. His name was Roland Hazard, by the way. And Roland Hazard was a millionaire. And his family was grooming him to take over this company, right? But he kept getting drunk. He could not stay sober. So he went to all the help he could get in the States. And finally, he went to this... The story says he went to the celebrated, here, I'll just read it. Then he had gone to Europe, placing himself in the care of the celebrated physician, the physician Dr. Jung. I don't know specifically, I think he knew Sigmund Freud and all those guys. They were kind of like in Dr. Abner, all in a similar circle. So this guy was like considered by many to be the great human power at the time on the earth. So he went to him with probably a blank check, I'm assuming, you know, help. And it says here that he though experience had made him skeptical, he finished his treatment with unusual confidence. The history says it was about a year. And above all, he believed that he had acquired such a profound knowledge of the inner workings of his mind and its hidden springs that relapse was unthinkable. And so a year in Switzerland with Carl Jung, probably with a blank check, and on his way home, someone asked him the wrong question. You know, you want a drink? And he said, yeah. Nevertheless, he was drunk within a short period of time. And those of you that are having trouble, or those of you that are in recovery and have actually gotten away from that, know that alcoholism is just cunning, baffling, and powerful. And no matter what, who we talk to, what happens, frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. It doesn't matter if your kids are begging you and your wife says they're going to leave, or the boss says they're going to fire you, you're not going to be able to quit. And he had this experience. And Carl Jung did two things for him that he said that were probably some of the most pivotal things that probably got this whole thing going. And so, first of all, he went back to him. So he said, so he returned to the doctor, whom he admired, and asked him point blank why he could not recover. He wished above all things to gain his self-control. He seemed quite rational, well-balanced with respect to other problems. He had a lot of money, so I mean, that was probably baffling. I don't know anybody that's really wealthy that has this problem, but I'm sure people go, huh, you know, I got mansions and money and women and cars, or vice versa, men or whatever's gender, but I can't stay sober. I'm baffling. You know, I can imagine that, you know, and he's like, doctor, help me. And he begged the doctor to tell him the truth, and he got it. This was the first thing. In the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless. Now imagine, the great human mind, you got a blank check, and you're going to this guy saying, I got drunk again, help, help. And the doctor says, there's nothing I can do for you. Utterly shocked. You know, he's like, he said, you know, you could never again regain your position in society, or you must place yourself under lock and key or hire a bodyguard if you expect to live long. This was the great physician's opinion. But this man still lives and is a free man. And it goes on to say, other things the doctor said. You have the mind of a chronic alcoholic. I have never seen one, God, this gets me, never seen one single case recover where the state of mind exists to the extent that it does in you. Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had clanged on him with a bang. You know, I've done a lot of time in jail, and we'll get to that. But I know what those 300-pound metal doors sound like when they slam them. Bam! And that, when I read that, I get that. And I know that. And if you're here and you're hopeless, you know that. And so she told him that, you know, I can't do nothing for you, man. Your money isn't worth anything here. And then the other thing he said, which was powerful, and this is why I'm bringing this up to start the meeting. It says, he said to the doctor, is there no exception? Probably like, please, man, there's got to be something. I can imagine, you know. And he said, yes, the doctor replied. There is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have what is called a vital spiritual experience. And I have had one of those. And I hope that you feel some of that tonight. It gets me emotional to think about it. To me, these occurrences are a phenomenon. This is the doctor saying. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes that were once the guiding forces of these men suddenly are cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begins to dominate them. And he goes on to say that a religious experience of that is not necessarily true, although it can be. What I believe, and let me read this. This letter is a response to Bill Wilson writing typing an 8-page letter to Carl Jung. He did it in the like 50s, and then the response is in 1961. The letterhead is typed from Urich by Carl Jung. And I'm not going to bore you with the whole thing. I'm just going to get to the meat and potatoes of it. Bill was like raving that if it wasn't for him getting Roland or telling Roland Hazard two things: number one, no human power can help you, and number two, you got to find a spiritual experience, which is the key of this program. Okay, and the other thing he said is you can recover if you find the right spiritual experience. It doesn't necessarily mean religion, but it can be. And then this is part I love. So he went on, Bill was thanking him and saying, without you doing that, Roland Hazard, by the way, appeared in court for Ebbie Thatcher because they were going to throw the book at Ebbie Thatcher. And then Ebbie Thatcher went to Bill Wilson's kitchen and this whole thing took off. And it's crazy how it happened. But so I'm going to narrow it down to this. So he's saying this about Roland Hazard. Roland Hazard's craving for alcohol was the equivalent on a low level of a spiritual thirst for our wholeness of being, expressed in medieval language, the union with God. So what I was really doing all those years drinking and doing drugs is I was having a spiritual experience of sorts. It changed my perception of reality. It made me okay in my skin. I was medicating with that. And it was a whole new world to me. But what I really sought was God, the God of my understanding. And that's what the program says. Why don't you choose your own concept? I have theories about what that God is, but that's my personal belief. But that's what I always sought. And who'd have thought that? We're drinking and we're seeking God. You'd never think that. It's the last thing I would think. And that's probably why it's absolutely true. According to this guy, it's true. So that's all I wanted to start with and read a couple other things, because I was hopeless when I came here. You know, I couldn't stop drinking. I couldn't stop getting in trouble. I couldn't stop getting in fights and hurting the people I loved. And I didn't know how to stop that. And I just knew that every time I got stressed out, irritated, afraid, or lonely, I would have to pour alcohol and drugs. Drugs are a part of my story. I'll just say this. I used everything I could to not feel mad. And it would change my reality for a moment. But the window of euphoria got shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. And the wreckage, towards the end, I could look back at the twisted bodies and cars and houses and incarcerations and just shake my head and go, oh my God, how am I ever going to clean up that mess? Well, God makes that possible. He makes that possible. So, welcome to the newcomers. I'm going to read this one thing and then I'm going to get into my story. You might be wondering, you know, if you're new, what this is all about. This is what it's about. Page 45, lack of power. That was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how were we to find this power? Well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. And that goes in totally with what Carl Jung said. So anyway, I am 48 years old, and I started drinking really young. I've got some pictures somewhere in our stuff of, I had a bottle of Bacardi in my hand. I was about my daughter's age, probably 9 or 10 years old. And I think I was drinking with my parents, Irish family, you know what I mean? And I think they didn't have the camera ready or whatever at the time I was taking the swigs. Somebody probably fumbled it because I had taken the swig, or someone said, here, Matt, take a drink. Okay. But the picture was after I had taken the drink and was like that, setting the bottle down. Bacardi 151. I was probably 9 years old. And that was cool with my family. That was my family. And so you can imagine it wasn't any problem to get alcohol. And you know, as long as I did it in the house, you know, it was okay. I remember my dad saying that, don't go anywhere, just do here. And there was drinking at the lake. We did the lake a lot, and oh my God, it became a problem really early on. I went into high school, I was drinking. I remember, this is a memory that stuck with me. I was a sophomore in high school, and I was in Stan Rose's welding shop. I don't know if you remember that, if you ever went to Rigetti. Stan Rose's welding shop. And I had a duffel bag I keep my books in, but I had a half gallon of 10 High whiskey in that. And I was drinking it before class. That was like fifth period. So I was already hammered. And I had set it on one of those, you know, those little stools. And it slipped off and broke and shattered. And And someone goes, hey, Matt, your bag fell. And I look, and there's a puddle of booze, and it's just all on my books. And I'm like, God. And no one knew. I just picked it up and threw it in the trash outside and mopped up the whiskey, and someone might have went, what's that smell? And I just kept going on. It was normal for Matt to drink alcohol. And then the trouble came, the fighting and things like that. And I'm not going to claim I was ever a tough guy. I just got in a lot of fights. You learn not to get hit after you get hit a lot. So that would happen. And then violence and alcohol, and they start throwing the book at you. That happened really young. I can remember juvenile hall being there, intoxicated in the drunk tank in juvenile hall. I did decent at school when I was there, which was rare. You know what I mean? I remember one year, I think it was a sophomore, I started the year, I was like, man, I got all A's. And they're like, dude, we've only been in school for like a month. Everybody has an A in a month. and then slowly the grades go, because I'm cutting class and I'm drinking booze. And it seemed like that's what everybody did. But as I talk to people I went to high school with now, they're like, no, dude, you were doing that. I was like, well, okay. And trouble, and I tried to have fun, but I couldn't really have fun because I would be the guy vomiting in the rose bushes at the end of the cake party, right? But so then the serious incarcerations and the real pain. I think I was probably a stone cold alcoholic at maybe 12, drinking regularly, like weekly, probably 15 or 16. I could just go into the refrigerator and get alcohol when I was a kid. There was no problem. I don't know if anybody can relate to that, but it was just everywhere, you know. And by the time I was in my early 20s, I was in serious trouble. I was in trouble with the law. I was on probation. I can't remember specifically what it was. I got in a fight and lost all else. I think I hit a guy with a beer bottle in a bar. And I'm in cars. I had enlisted in the U.S. Navy before that. So, you know, my dad went to my attorney and goes, hey, you know, he's going in the Navy. And they said, they brought it up to court. And somehow this attorney schmoozed him. And they go, okay, well, as long as you go in the Navy, it's in 2 weeks? Okay, we're going to let you out in 2 weeks. And then I literally left jail and went in the Navy. And awesome. I thought, man, I skated another one. And I get in the Navy, and they're the biggest damn drunks in there, man. Oh my gosh, they're the biggest drunks in the world. In the Navy, they drink alcohol. There's a bar right at the edge of the base, 32nd Street, and I was in there all the time. You know, I'm not paying any rent. You know, getting money from the military, and that didn't last very long, and there was a lot of trouble with that. And then, I'm gonna get right to it pretty much so I can get to some of the solution-based stuff. You know, I think you guys get it. I had a problem with drinking, you know. Had a mean streak, just a country mile wide, and I just couldn't figure out why. And low self-esteem and thought I was tough and tried to be the center of attention but was really, like, this big inside. Tragedy, man. What's the saying? It says, egomaniac with an inferiority complex. I was a lost guy, man. And, you know, I talked to some people that I've known for many, many years, and they see me now, and they're like, who the hell are you, dude? Well, I thought you were doing life in prison, Matt. No? But speaking of that, I started doing some serious time and did a couple stints in the prison system. I'm going, okay, a couple more than a couple. And for different violences and things like that, being abusive to this woman right here. I kicked a door into her face in a drunken stupor. I remember we had separated, and I'm okay talking with this now because that's not me. That's just something that happened. It's part of my story, and I really want you to get the gravity of this. But I'd been forced to come and live in Santa Maria in my mom's little mobile home on McCoy, and she didn't want me in the house. I was a maniac. Was doing drugs and drinking, and our daughter was small, I wanted to see her one day, and I had been doing dope all night and drinking whiskey in the morning to try to make that come down from that high. And I remember knocking on the door in the little place that we used to live at, and the door opened with the chain. I mean, she knew it was me, and it's just the chain, right? You open the door and you see the chain. I'm like, I want to see Anira. That's my daughter, Anira. She's my whole world. She's my treasure, and she's gonna be 11 next year. And you believe that, Billy? 11, man. Seen her when she was just, and she smelled the booze on my breath. Probably just looked at my eyes. I was just insane. She told me, like, the other day, yesterday, I think, she said everybody that I'd known in Lompoc at that time, it was in Lompoc, too, that they called me Crazy Matt. That was me. The crazy guy. Running around, being a maniac, drinking, just have it, drinking and driving. You know, if there was anything you had that wasn't nailed down, I was probably putting it in my pocket. She said, no, you can't see Anira. And why wouldn't she, man? Freaking drunken maniac, you know, and verbally, I was just an awful guy. You know, I left because I should be in jail. She shut the door, and I remember just feeling like rage, like, how dare you keep me from my child? I never thought about my kid seeing me intoxicated. That never crossed my mind. Not once. I just thought about, how dare you shut the door on my, it's not even my house. She's paying the rent now. And I guess she told me later that she was like, she had her head against the door. She was like crying, like, I can't let my husband in the house right now because he's intoxicated and he's sick. And I didn't see any of that. I just kicked the door. Boom! And it came off the frame. And I'm sorry. I'm embarrassed. Did some physical damage to her face and off to prison again. Another violent felony. And That's what I do when I drink alcohol. I'm not some little sissy guy that sits in the corner on my golf cart. Sorry if you drive a golf cart. You know what I mean? I crash my golf cart on the golf course. You know, I'm here, you know, because I crashed it into an oak tree. And, you know, no, I'm a serious maniac when I drink alcohol. I'm not a rational man. I hurt people I love. I don't care about anything but what I need to get in life. And that's the epitome of self-centeredness. And, you know, that's just, I'm only going to share that of my trauma. I just, and I didn't get sober from that. I went to prison. I did, oh God, I think I did almost the better part of 2 years, and I got out, and I was back at it immediately. Immediately, man. I remember thinking, I was going to meetings in there, you know what I mean, and going to AA and church and meditation, and I was like all, ooh, I was like on the yard doing yoga, like I'm the guy or some shit, you know, and I was just insane. And, you know, I've been doing, you know, I looked at Kevin, I just remembered, I've been doing Zen meditation during this time for probably 15 years, in and out of incarceration. I knew I was in trouble, and I knew there was some, I've been a baptized Holy Ghost, washed by the blood of Jesus Christ Christian. I did everything I could do. Like Stan says, he's not here anymore, but there was never enough holy water to wash away that sickness. I just tried everything, you know, I made the confession of faith. I did all that, and I believed it, the truth, and I still do today. But it didn't work because, not because that God failed me or the God failed me, but I failed him. I didn't know how to let go. And so fast forward a couple years, you know, I didn't go to, I locked up anymore. I skated and didn't get in trouble, but I stayed loaded. And then 2014, September 5th, 2014, I'm walking across Broadway, drunk. I had my daughter that day in one of those little things behind the bike, you know, little shroud things, you know. And I'm zipping around. I guess I'm drunk on whiskey, and I don't even remember this. I don't remember. And she told me later that somehow I dropped my daughter off of my mom's, and she came and got her. I had my bike. I was walking across the street. And on Broadway, way down on South Broadway by the car lot, it's two lanes each way, and I was going over the center divider or between the brake and the center divider, and one car slowed down, the closest one to the center divider, and another car didn't even see me, zipped around that car because they saw the taillights, and hit me square on, man. And I went flying, and I was messed up, man. I was hospitalized, in and out of it, 70-something days like that. They rebuilt my knee later. Had a serious traumatic brain injury. And I guess I was dead for a period of time. I don't know exactly. I mean, I have some papers that say that. Anyway, it was just bad. I shouldn't have survived. I was intoxicated. That may have saved me. I don't know. But And I didn't get sober from that. And then what happened after that is several months later, I was in my mom's house, or about a year later. Well, no, it was almost 2 years later. I was in my mom's house, and I'd been doing methamphetamines and drinking alcohol, and I was ready to take my life. And I had a plan. I was going to take an ice cube and chill my arm as long as I could, and then take a razor blade from my razor knife, because I'm a carpenter and I know how to do stuff like that, and just go in the shower and slice my arm and have a hot shower, and just no thought of what that would happen to my mom when she came in. Man, how come you're not coming out of there? I never thought about stuff like that. I just wanted to go away. And then one thought came, and I'll never forget this. It was like me, but it was not me. And it goes, this thought, this voice and a thought at the same time. I can't even describe it. It goes, is that what you want to leave that little girl? Yeah. Yeah, I got up and I walked to the 1600 Club. And that was December 1st, 2016. And if you're new, I just can encourage you, if you're at that place, just keep walking to meetings. Because I just kept walking to meetings. Three a day, I guess I did for a while, and I wasn't working at the time, so. And I would walk by these, on the way from McCoy Lane all the way to the 1600 Club, there's a lot of roads where there's trash, you know, blowing through the fences, and I would go to like the dollar store and buy trash bags, and I would pick up the trash. Not because I'm some kind of a, you know, humanitarian or something like that, but I just intuitively knew that I was a selfish SOB. And that if I didn't do something immediately to get out of myself, I was going to go back to that. And I didn't want to be in that place of contemplating suicide, which is where alcohol ultimately takes me, and drugs. So I kept going, and I kept going, and kept going. I got Lee C to ask me to sponsor, and I said, hey man, help. And he goes, okay, you ready? Yeah. And he got busy, and he fired at some steps at me, he fired at some writing at me, he told me to call him every day for like 30 days, and I called him every day for 157 days, I think. And I prayed on my knees to God. I just said, help! I know you're out there. I see people recover. I've watched it happen. I said, just help me. I can't stop drinking. I'm broke. And the greatest prayer I've ever said is help, because it's absolutely an abandoned point. I knew that there was no other hope for me. I was going to die. And it's not like I felt the clouds part, you know, and the sunlight came into the room when I prayed. I'd known to come to AA because I'd watched people recover, and I heard the message keep coming back, and I'd seen guys like Jack and other people, and I knew this guy. And, you know, thank you for all those times we set up the meeting, dude, over at the Lion Stand. That shit helped me so bad, because I just went every Tuesday. I'm like, man, and we would talk about God and spiritual stuff, and, you know, and how to get away from self, and how to, and I felt like something was coming into my life by doing that. When I talked to this guy, and I talked with Bob and my sponsor, everybody now, I get it in a huge way now, but it was just like a crack came through, a light came through, just a crack, and I was like, hey, that's different. Whoa, so I'm going to keep doing that stuff and create a habit of that. And I did. I didn't know I was creating a habit, but I did. And then I would read other spiritual books. I read books about Hinduism. I read the Bhagavad Gita. I read William James. I read everything I thought Bill Wilson was reading. Because there's all kinds of links on my phone. Silkworth.net. And I would listen to the Joe and Charlie's at night. I would go to sleep listening to this stuff. I would read the Bible, and I'd be like, okay, what is the Christ trying to say here? And because some of it was very ambiguous and hard to understand. He spoke in parables. And it's not that I can interpret it now, but I kind of understand what he meant now. It's about getting away from self, because this guy is the problem. And I think if you look at these steps, and you really look at these steps are a process of letting go. First, I got to let go that I have any power at all. And then I got to let go of whatever beliefs I have about a higher power, which is hasn't been enough in past time. So I got to have a new belief. And then that is changed, because now I'm incorporating old beliefs with new beliefs. And there's like a power flooding into my life now. And I can't describe it other than most people have seen the show Finding Nemo, right? Finding Nemo, right? I love this, right? So what's his name? I can't.
Crush.
Yeah, Crush the turtle. So he's trying to find Nemo. I'm looking for Nemo, right? And he goes in the ocean, right? And he runs into the turtles. Hey, bro, what's up? Oh, you're trying to get to Australia. We want to go this way. We're going to follow this special current, right? So they get in this like vortex of water, but it's all water. And if you look at someone's life from the outside, we're all in this life, right? You watch them just, boom, they're making sense what they're saying. They're talking better. They have a power flowing into their life now that they didn't have before. And it's not manufactured by self. I couldn't have gotten to where I am right now talking in front of you guys about this stuff if it was on my own thing. It wouldn't have been here for 3 years. I would have folded a long time ago if this was Matt's power. So it's like if the other fish are watching the turtles zoom down in the where they what's happening, it's baffling. But I feel like a power has flowed into my life because I'll make connections with people. And I feel like God's going, he's not saying anything audibly, because I'd be insane if I told you God spoke to me audibly. But I just feel like sometimes, don't go left, go right, Matt. Well, why? Well, because left is for you. Right is for someone else. Okay, I'm going to do that because I just believe that. And I'll do that. And then stuff happens, employment, the way I feel inside is, I feel closer. There's a power around me today that I can't describe. I can't describe it. It's like a presence. And they describe it for me. I don't have to describe it. The great fact is just this and nothing less, and that we've had deep and effective spiritual experience, which has revolutionized our whole attitude, life, toward our fellows and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. I absolutely have that feeling in my life now. I didn't have that before. And the only thing I could use evidence is I was a self-centered son of a gun before. And now I'm not so much that self-centered guy. Now I kind of see the steps as getting away from Matt and serving others. And so the book is loaded with this stuff. Page 20. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depends upon our constant thought of others and how we may help their needs. So my very life depends on a constant, not once in a while, but a stream of steady thinking about other people. Because when I'm thinking about me, I'm in a wreck. And I read this book a lot, and it's all making the same sense. Our real purpose, so that means us. That's kind of nice to know that you can find your purpose in life, huh? It's to fit myself. That means modify Matt to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. It's all through here. Helping others is the foundation stone of your recovery. A kindly act once in a while isn't enough. You have to act the good Samaritan every day if need be. So what I'm saying is I am not perfect by any standard, right? I make a lot of mistakes, and I called Victor, my first sponsor. Jack's my sponsor right there. He helps me a lot. Ted's helped me. And you, Bob, I mean, Billy, I have a wealth of... This man, I've had a wealth of friends in here that can help me, and I can run stuff by them and say, hey, look, I'm feeling this. What do you think I should do? What a concept. To take inside information. Leo says the loving God expresses himself in the group conscience. So that means God uses you guys to teach me, and he uses all of us to teach each other. And so I believe that God consciousness is the goal of this. At first, when I first got here, I thought, well, not drinking whiskey sounds like a pretty good goal. You know, not going to prison again, not hurting anybody sounds like a good goal. But God consciousness kind of covers all of that. So instead of thinking, okay, I want to stop drinking, I want to stop doing drugs, how do I say this? Okay, so I thought I had a lot of problems when I first came to AA. Well, when I first got sober in the beginning of 2017. I thought I had a relationship problem. I thought I had a parenting problem. I thought I had a car problem. Well, I actually did. I had a car that didn't quite shift on automatic. It would just wind out. So I couldn't go on the freeway because it would like go to 7,000 RPMs and blow up. So I just drive around town. At an ERV, early recovery vehicle. So, but I thought I had like a communication problem, a humor problem, which I still kind of do, but a problem making friends, keeping jobs. I thought I had all kinds of problems. But according to Carl Jung, and what I'm trying to kind of get at here is, I had one problem. I was too far away from my God, Tom. Too far away from God. That covers everything. So I don't have to isolate with, well, I need to get okay with Misty, or Jesse and I need to be better friends, or I need to be a funnier guy. No, I just need to get close to God again. And he's going to commence to accomplish things for me that I couldn't do for myself. It's all in the book. It's all in the book, man. So so I got to take my family to Maui several weeks ago. Not that far ago. How long ago was it? A month? A month ago. Got to take my wife and my daughter to Maui. And I've never been anywhere. I've been all over to California on a state bus. Okay? Don't let me kid you. I've been to Chino. I've been to Soledad. I've been to Susanville. I've been to Corcoran. I've been to CMC. I've been to Jamestown. I've been Lancaster. Thank you. She knows a couple more. Yeah. I can't. So I've been to as many, by the way, I've been to as many prisons as I've been on medications for different disorders, but it turned out I just needed to get to God, and that was my big problem, and I needed to trust God, clean house, and help others. That's what I need to do, and I still do that today because Nate, it's working, brother. It's working, and if something is working, there's no need to change it. Because I don't have the counterfeit. Like, alcohol was the counterfeit. So, when I had a problem, little Jack Daniels, oh yeah, I don't have to worry about Misty anymore. I'll be all right. Well, that's a problem because it doesn't work. It's a counterfeit. It seems to work. But according to Carl Jung, according to the first 100 to put this book together, according to most of the men that I talk to in Alcoholics Anonymous, what I really need is God. And so far, when I do that, everything is taken care of. I'm employable today. I can be a father today. I can be a friend today. I can be a significant other to this person. I can be a buddy. I can help you with your house. I have skills. Hey! I'd name all the people that I've helped in here, but I don't want, you know, the purpose of taxes. I'll just keep it quiet. But I used that already, but... So I'm also in private therapy now as well, and I didn't get any weird responses to that. Thank God. I told that at the Freedom Group. That was a humorous thing. I said, "Hey, because I'm all excited about this new stuff my therapists teach me, right?" I'm like, "Well, and a couple different responses, right? One lady looked away like she saw like an invisible mouse run across the floor. I was like, "Whoa!" Most people just look at me like a monitor lizard. So you're in therapy, huh? You know you need professional help when you mention you're in therapy and people are like... But this therapist is amazing and he's given me tools that are... And he challenges me and he doesn't take smack because I've read a lot of books and I like to think I'm an intellectual, but he's very intelligent. He's given me real tools to use in relations to people, family, and friends, and I need that. And let's just face it, for me, you can never go wrong by getting someone with a master's degree in psychology on board with a crazy alcoholic trying to do his best he can. And I don't know why I ever waited so long for that, you know, and I incorporate that with my God consciousness today, you know, the steps, and I'm on step 8. And I'm making a list, and there are people I've harmed in recovery by my behavior and my actions, and I don't want to do that anymore. You know, I don't want to harm people, but I don't want to codependently let people walk all over me. So there's a careful navigation in that in life. You know, some people need to be told no, and I need to walk away from them. And I'll use this as an example. My brother came into town. He's not in the meeting, so I can say this. My brother has been a crazy alcoholic like me, and he's still in his cups, and he uses drugs too, and he's verbally abused my wife, he's verbally abused my sister who just lost her daughter, he's verbally abused my mom. He managed to bunk at her house and call me like, help. And I'm like, okay, all right, well, I've been trained, I know what to do. You know, I said, all right, well, the 1600 Club's over here, meet me there. He met me there. I got him a book. I got him a schedule. And I told him, you're not working. You're living at mom's. Go to 3 meetings a day. Get a sponsor. I can't sponsor you. We're too close. There's other stuff there, too. You know, I didn't threaten him. The old Matt wanted to pound on him a little bit. But you know what? I have to open my hand to people. You know, I have to be of service to people and to God by being an example of Alcoholics Anonymous and not being that guy I used to be. That guy, I did a lot of stupid stuff, but that ain't me. That's just something I had done. So I tried, and you know, he was working an angle. So I finally just said, hey, man, every time he'd text me something rhetorically and nasty, and I'd say, well, you know, stop drinking, stop using, go to meetings, get a sponsor, read the book, pray and meditate. Kept just reiterating that to him, and you know, finally I had to just say enough, you know. But I called Jeremiah and I said, look, do I not talk to this dude anymore? This is my brother, you know. My dad's gone now. I need to step up and do something. And and he said, no, keep the channel open, just keep reiterating, go to meetings, and he may recover. Because I did, you know. I got sober, and I'm sure people didn't think I was ever gonna make it. So what I do today is I try to treat people with the love and dignity in my family and my child, and that they deserve. But more importantly, what I want from others, I try to give them. You know, seems to me that this guy a couple thousand years ago said, do unto others as you would have them do unto you, because I am doing it to me when I'm doing it to you, because what's inside, I'm going to get back. So if I'm all yucky in here, I'm going to be treating you bad. But if I'm okay in here, I got to treat you good, because that's a reciprocity back to me. You know, and I haven't discovered, God hasn't come through the clouds. You know, I'm getting close to the end of this. God hasn't come through the clouds and said, good job, Matt. But I feel it in the energy from people in the program that have done this deal, and they've been here longer than me. And we talk, and I feel a connection. And I know I'm on a path that... that I couldn't have done on my own. I can't get to it, it's locked. There's something I wanted to read from it as Bill sees it. Page 85, if you get a chance. Okay. Well, I'll read this last, because this is a huge impactor for me. It's one of the most profound readings that I've had, and I've read a lot of stuff. I'm a fan of Yogananda. I'm actually a fan of Jesus Christ, too. And I'll read Yogananda. This isn't blasphemy. And I'll go back and I'll read Jesus Christ, so what he said, and I understand what he meant. I get it. You know, as a man thinketh in his heart, therefore he is. Have a positive attitude, believe good, expect good, and good comes into your life. I never had that before. I always expected the negative. It was always, the shoe was going to drop next. I was always looking at the glass half empty. And what can I get? And that hasn't completely flipped, but it's gotten considerably better. And so I read a lot of different stuff. But this one really got me. And I hope you guys enjoy this. And, you know, I hope I didn't traumatize anybody with my bullshit. But, you know, I have a lot of energy for this meeting. And I have a lot of energy for Alcoholics Anonymous. Because there's a power in here. If you're new and you don't know this, there is an absolute power in this meeting, in this room right now. That all you have to do is just get out of the way enough and ask for help, and it happens. It happened for me, it can happen for you. So, I'm glad you have this. I'm going to close with this. Page 85 is Bill sees it. This is an amazing book. I thought this book was grainy. I was like, oh God, I can't even get that. Now I love it. Life is not a dead end. When a man or woman has a spiritual awakening, the most important meaning of it is that he has now become able to do, feel, and believe that which he could not do before on his unaided strength and resources alone. He has been granted a gift which amounts to a new state of consciousness and being. He has been set on a path which tells him he is really going somewhere. That life is not dead. Not something to be endured or mastered. In a very real sense, he has been transformed. Because he has laid hold of a source of strength which he has hitherto denied himself. You know, with Carl Jung's theory is that when we come to this earth, and this is my personal belief, we're blocked off from God. We don't remember what we had going on in that other place. But he finds little ways to nudge you and remind you. So, it's about God. That's all I got. Thank you.
I'm going to have to go to the bathroom in a little bit.
All right, let's have another round of applause.